Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Well, I guess to get started, maybe you could read one of these letters, sure. Leonard. Leonard Garfield, Executive Director of MOHAI. And I'm Gabriel Spitzer, by the way. But go ahead, Leonard.
To the Honorable City Council, Seattle, the attention of the North End Progressive Club has been called to this little colony of poverty-stricken people who have built shacks on the sand at Inner Bay Waterfront. It was pointed out that an unsanitary condition might exist there and that these unsightly shacks annoyed the people who had property in the vicinity. We recognize the fact that these people have drifted in from other parts of the country, that no funds are available for other housing, that it is unlawful to shoot or drown them, but we want you to do something about it.
Great. And then there's one more. Could you just read the first sort of chunk of this letter too?
To the City Council, a critical situation has arisen in Hooverville, wherein unemployed and aged people with no source of income are being evicted. They have no place to go, and the authorities, having jurisdiction over relief, do not intend to make any provisions for them at all. This will greatly affect the health and welfare of all the people of the city. And for the immediate help, we are asking that the mayor and the city council use the police powers to stop homeless people from being evicted in face of a housing shortage and in face of the coming winter.
So when do these letters date from?
Well, these letters date from the late 1930s, during the depths of the Great Depression.
Well, as you can hear, these issues of homelessness and indigence and how neighbors respond to them when they're confronted with them right in their backyard have been with us for a really long time here in Seattle. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to hear more stories of how this played out in Seattle history, as well as stories of how it's playing out today right here around our region. It's just ahead on KPLU's Sound Effect, so don't go away. We're going to start in a part of Seattle where there's been some tension lately. In the Magnolia and Inner Bay neighborhoods, some say things have taken a turn for the worse. An increase in homeless people living in RVs, more property crime, and blight. A group of residents has even hired a private security force to patrol the neighborhood. And so that, in turn, has brought accusations of elitism and intolerance toward poverty, and the epithet NIMBY, not in my backyard. It's a term Harley Lever does not care for. He's a big, good-natured guy, originally from Boston, which will be very obvious. Now, a little later in the show, we're going to get the perspective of a homeless person in Magnolia, but first we get a little tour of Harley's neighborhood, heading down Thorndike Road toward the Ballard Locks.
Really, from right here, you would find needles. And I'm not talking one needle or two needles. I'm talking you'd see 10 here. You know, it wasn't uncommon to come across 100 needles walking from here to the Ballard Locks.
Really? That's going to sound like an exaggeration to some people.
Yeah, I'm sure it does, but it's the absolute truth. I mean, we have video of it. We have photographs of it. But actually, here we go. Here's a needle plunger right here.
Wait, really?
Yeah, that's a plunger to a needle. So this is exactly what we see all the time. That RV that had caught fire had 150 needles just in the trash. I mean, there was just needles everywhere.
Maybe you could just describe what encountering that RV, like, just tell me the story, walk me through it.
Sure. So I was driving down here one day, and all of a sudden we see this burned out shell of an RV. All the contents inside had been ripped out, and it was just a horrifying sight. I came up and looked at it more closely and just noticed these flasks that had residue in it. And, you know, to me, I'm like, okay, this is clearly a crystal meth lab. At that point, I said, you know, enough's enough. For the last 2 years, we've been calling Mayor Murray. We had no response. So out of frustration, I took a video of the RV, and it just went viral. It turns out that other neighbors around Ballard and Magnolia had been calling constantly and had the same lack of response from the city government. So we all got together, and then we end up forming the Neighborhood Safety Alliance. There was a lot of legitimately homeless people living in the RVs, but there was a lot of criminals hiding among them. Unfortunately, though, a lot of the problematic ones have now moved to the Green Lake area. While it's changed for us here in Inter Bay, I think unfortunately for some neighbors in Seattle, it's just that the crime's kind of moved over there. I'm not fooling myself. I know that the situations haven't really changed much.
So what do you think people in other parts of town who haven't experienced this, but who just know, hey, it's Magnolia, hey, it's Inter Bay, hey, it's Queen Anne, what do you think they don't understand or misunderstand about what's going on here?
People in have said, oh, Magnolia, they're a bunch of rich folks, and they call us NIMBYs, not in my backyard. But I would remind them that, one, this is Inter Bay. It's a blue-collar neighborhood, and, you know, I don't want this in anyone's neighborhood.
So the comments have gotten pretty heated in some quarters, and there have been a few occasions where there have been actual confrontations, you know, with people who seem like they're legitimately homeless. Do you feel like things have gotten a little out of hand?
I do. You know, I see a big divide here in the city. You have one group that looks at the homeless people as all criminals, and then you have the other group that says all homeless people are innocent. You know, so when you have such a polar divide, it's really hard to look at it in the middle. And what I always promote is I think we all need to come together and really just get down to what's going to work and what's not going to work.
When people make an assumption about you that you don't care about the well-being of addicted people or poor people or homeless people, do you take that personally at all?
No, I don't take it personally. I just think we just have not had the opportunity to talk. I've got a addicted brother who's basically overdosed 4 times in the last year.
He's addicted to what?
He's addicted to heroin, but he's a multi-user. He's a former vet. He was in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. He went into the Army addicted, and he came out with PTSD, started using again. And so that's why I have such an urgency to try to mitigate what's going on with our heroin issues here in Seattle.
Are you close with your brother?
I was at one point. He's been in and out of VA hospitals, and he's been homeless, so I haven't seen him in probably 3 or 4 years.
What's it been like to watch him deteriorate like that?
You know, it's absolutely heartbreaking. You have a kid who's, you know, happy-go-lucky all of his life, ultra smart. He was the kid you knew was going to be like the genius of the family. And then high school hit, and everyone started experimenting with OxyContin. And from that point on, it's been an absolute nightmare. He stole $5,000 from my mom on Christmas. He can't help himself, you know? And this is not who Dave is.
So having that as part of your family history, are you thinking about that when you see people here in your own neighborhood who are struggling? To what extent is that kind of in your mind and your mentality when you're dealing with the side of it that's dangerous, the side of it that's ugly, the side of it that's sort of encroaching on your own neighborhood?
Yeah, well, it's my very first thought when I see, you know, I think of my brother, and like, you know, this is Dave up here, and he's having issues. But at the same breath, you know, we as our family, we can't let Dave live with us. We can't lend him any money. You know, heroin's one of those deals where it'll flip your sense of love on its head, because the things you naturally think that you can do to help a person hurt heroin addicts. And so we can't even give him presents anymore, because he'll sell his presents for heroin. And it's a game of Russian roulette. So you know that the next dollar, you know, 10 bucks you give him could be the one that causes him to overdose. And so when I see these people struggling, I know that they're stealing because they have to fight off addiction. I'm humbled because I know exactly what they're going through. So you have to be compassionate first and foremost.
That's a really powerful insight. How, first of all, crazy that must make you when your impulse is just to do something kind, and you know that that is turned around and that's like not what you should be doing. I mean, do you feel like that's at work on a bigger scale in this city?
I mean, honestly, I think I see Seattle as an enabler right now. I think that's what the biggest problem is there are no hard consequences for heroin addicts here. Our family prayed so many times that our brother would get arrested just to have him stop using. You know, jail was the safest place for him. And I know there's a lot of parents out there that feel the same exact way. It's like, you know, please arrest my kid. Please get him some help. And right now, you know, that's not happening here.
As you and your neighbors wrestle with these issues, what's one thing you would want the city and the region at large to understand better about this place and the people like you who are trying to make changes?
Let's stop taking the cheap shots at one another. Let's stop with the frustrations. Let's come up with some solutions and work together, because there are people literally dying on the streets. I think we need just a top-to-bottom restructuring of our homeless service response system, as well as the addiction response. But let's come together first and foremost.
Well, Harley Lever, thank you for showing me around your neighborhood.
Yeah, Gabriel, thank you for having me. I really appreciated talking with you, and hope our paths cross again.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is In My Backyard. If you're lucky, you know who lives next door to you, and you get along. Neighbors are supposed to look out for each other, right? But what if the place next door is one of those scary houses? A place where drug deals go down, where there always seems to be a party going on at 3 a.m, where domestic violence happens and fights break out and police visit a lot. Well, this is the story of two neighbors grappling in very different ways with what to do about that house. Sound Effect contributor Jennifer Wing headed there in Seattle's South Park neighborhood.
A lot is packed into a small place in South Park. It's kind of out of the way, tucked between State Route 509 and the Duwamish River. The people who live here love the small town feel. They catch up at Via Vadi, the neighborhood's only coffee shop. Good pizza, Mexican food, and beer from the local brewery are just steps away. But there's also a lot of crime.
The drugs.
I saw a lady getting beat up.
The gang activity. Don't make eye contact. Don't look at them.
A cop never showed up, and the guy was dragging her somewhere, and I never ended up seeing where they went.
The prostitution that just happens in cars on the street.
They broke into my garage by taking the boards off. On the alley side.
Degenerate people doing whatever they want. It's not neighborly.
That's Farah Clinch, Max Lambeau, and Joseph Murphy. Even though they've all been witnesses to and victims of crime, they all agree with their neighbor, Jeff Hayes, who truly believes that 99% of the people in South Park are wonderful. He loves this place.
It's one of the most ethnically diverse neighborhoods in the city. Has more children per capita than probably most other neighborhoods in the city. If there's gonna be a neighborhood in the city that is representative of what city leaders say they want Seattle to be, it is South Park.
Jeff is 55 years old. He's a retired captain with the Seattle Fire Department. His brother is a retired Washington State Patrol officer. His brother-in-law and his nephew are cops in Kennewick.
Police officers are near and dear to my heart and are an integral part of my family.
Jeff is the block captain of block captains. He's a big man with a shaved head and a soul patch. He has lived in the same wood frame craftsman house on South Cloverdale for 17 years with his wife. They raised their daughter in this home. Out in the garage is where Jeff keeps his Harley Davidson, a road king. Not only does he know which homes brew the trouble in South Park where the pimps, the drug dealers, and the gang members live, he reports what he sees to police. One of these homes is right next door.
It's always been a problem.
It's his neighbor's house. Victoria and Stephen Blacktongue and their 5 children. Blacktongue, it's an unusual name. Stephen was born and raised on the Blackfoot Indian Reservation in Montana. Since April 2014, Seattle police have visited their modest single-story home 23 times.
You know, I've got emails going back 2 years to appropriate officials complaining about the obvious criminal activities going on over there.
One incident a few months ago involved a group of teenagers from the house who started randomly attacking things outside with a pickaxe.
One of my fellow neighbors came out of her house running with a phone in her hand and said, "Jeff, you need to go around to the back alley. There's some kids back there with a pickaxe, and they've taken to our fence, and they've taken to our boat, and I'm afraid they're going to go after my husband."
911, what are you reporting? My husband just went after some kids in our back alley, jumped over the fence. So I think they were beating on our fence. And the kids are out of control.
From the street, the Black Tongue house looks a little run down, but nothing out of the ordinary. However, when you go around the back in the alley, the small yard is packed with an incredible amount of garbage. An abandoned car, what looks like a busted washing machine, an RV that's seen better days, has a blue tarp over its roof. It's a giant mess that can only be made right with the help of a tow truck, a backhoe, and a dumpster. It's a stark contrast to Jeff's yard next door, which has a wooden fence free of graffiti and a neatly trimmed lawn. As we stand in the alley, a maroon sedan pulls up. With the car running, a man gets out. Jeff doesn't recognize him and goes inside the back door of the Black Tongue house.
And I don't know what that guy's doing. I've never seen that guy before. I've never seen that vehicle before. If I called 911 right now, they would say, well, what are you reporting? And I'd say, well, I'm reporting suspicious activity. Well, what makes it suspicious? And they end up making you feel like a fool for even calling 911 when you know that there's something bad going on. And I've been doing this for years. That's what I live next to.
Jeff Hayes has made many attempts to try and change the situation next door, to somehow make a dent in the chaos.
I have knocked on the door several times and spoken to Mr. Black Tongue, and was told that a lot of the people that are using his house for fencing stolen property and buying drugs are not people that he knows, and he has no control over it. I said, well, why don't you call the police? And he said, because I'm a convicted felon and I just don't talk to police anymore. When I would go around to the back and actually confront the people in back, I would be threatened with violence. My house would be threatened with fire. They would threaten my family.
Jeff has called the police dozens of times. He sent multiple emails to Seattle's Department of Construction and Inspections about the garbage. He's called the State Department of Social and Health Services to report that he can see the teenagers next door drinking alcohol and getting high. Jeff says the state told him there isn't enough evidence to open a case looking into the welfare of the kids. The city's Department of Construction and Inspections has been out to take a look at the property and is now fining the home's owner, Victoria Black Tongue, for the conditions outside. So far, she owes more than $1,000.
I can't pay that. Sure, I'll give you guys that money and tell the mortgage company, sorry, I don't know what to do.
The day I knock on Victoria's door, or Vicky, as she likes to be called, there's a piece of paper taped to the front. In red marker are these words: stay away. You know who you are. Don't ever come back. Vicky is tired. She's missing some teeth. She's dealt with depression most of her life and is on disability. She quit using heroin years ago and goes to a methadone clinic twice a week.
I haven't given them a dirty UA since 2007.
UA is a...
Urine analysis where they screen us for drugs in our system.
Vicky knows what people are saying about her property and what goes on here.
I'm doing my best. I don't know if they could see it or they can tell.
The room we're in, the living room, is really clean. The bare wood floors are still drying after being mopped, and there's a faint smell of bleach in the air. There's a couch, a few pictures of the kids when they were small, not much else. The house was built by her grandfather in the 1960s and passed down to Vicky by her mother. To understand how things got to where they are today, you have to go back several years to when Stephen Black Tongue, her husband, got out of jail for attempted murder. When his parole ended, Vicky says old habits returned and he started doing hard drugs again. Then there was a fire at the house, so they brought in the RV to live in while the place was being fixed up. All the while, Vicky says the kids were growing up watching their dad shoot up, getting high, and stealing stuff. They eventually got out of hand, too.
You know, the last couple years, they were bringing other kids, unruly kids, would come over here. This is the place to be unruly. No. I didn't know what to do. I was trapped. I was overwhelmed. My kids were off the hook. My husband was off the hook. I couldn't get my husband to help me with the kids because he was worse than they were. I wanted to sneak out the window and run and hide, and nobody would find me ever again.
In December, Vicky says her husband got hooked on meth.
The lovely drug that it is drives him nuts. I didn't want him anywhere near me. I could tell. I know him. I've known him for how long now? And the way he's talking to me, his touch, everything, I didn't like it. I knew he was on that drug. I mean, he just kept getting worse and worse, and then, yeah, March 13th happened. That was horrible.
March 13th was the day Stephen Blacktongue walked into a 7-Eleven armed with an axe.
This is Q13 Fox News at 10.
A convenience store customer stopped a man who went on a violent hatchet rampage this morning by pulling out a pistol and shooting
him. It was Sunday, early in the morning. Stephen walked into a 7-Eleven near Burien carrying an axe. He started attacking the man behind the counter. He left a gash on the clerk's belly, but before he could cause any more harm, another customer with a legal concealed gun shot Blacktongue, killing him. Vicky doesn't know exactly why her husband did this. She suspects it was the meth that made him lose his mind. Vicky is trying to piece together a life that does not involve drugs, robberies, gangs, vandalism, or visits from the police. She's trying to keep the kids and their friends who want to use the place to store stolen property away from the house. There's a man living in the RV out back she doesn't really know. Even though he's pretty quiet, she still wants him out. She says hauling the RV away would cost $500.
I don't have that. I'm kind of stuck right now.
And then there's the problem with the condition of the house itself. Tara Salazar, Vicky's longtime friend, says the place doesn't have any running water. Tara says Stephen Blacktongue's drug addict friends went under the house and took all of the pipes.
They came and stole her copper plumbing, but then after they put the plumbing in, they crawled under their house and stole it again. There's no plumbing.
So you're home. You can't use the bathroom.
We lined the toilets with garbage bags. And my son takes the garbage out.
Vicky says the city stopped collecting the trash months ago. So for now, garbage bags filled with human waste are stored in the backyard. She says police have told her that where the pipes used to be in the crawl space, this is where suspects on the run in the neighborhood sometimes hide out. Even though Vicky wants to turn things around and make things right with people like her neighbor, Jeff Hayes, the criminal element of South Park might refuse to let go of this house. Meanwhile, Jeff has complained to the right people, the right agencies. Now all he can do is wait for something to happen. It could take a while, and he's really frustrated.
It feels like as a citizen, I'm in a cage and the police department puts me on the hamster wheel to run in a circle because they don't want to have to deal with me outside of the cage and have to really deal with it, the issues that are confronting this neighborhood.
We've been dealing with Mr. Hayes and the Blacktongue house for quite some time.
This is Pierre Davis. He's the captain of Seattle's Southwest Police Precinct, which includes South Park. He says police can't do anything without building a case. The Blacktongues have rights just like everyone else.
If you're going to do something narcotics-wise, because that seems to be the crux of a lot of the issues down there, there's probable cause that has to be developed. And we just can't build this stuff out of thin air. There has to be a certain amount of workup that's associated with that. We can't flood the area and kick people out of their houses or arrest them for no reason. There has to be something there for us to go forward.
So what about the physical state of the Blacktongue property, the garbage, the RV, the trash bags of sewage? Is there anything the city can do about that? Brendan Brophy, an assistant city attorney for Seattle, says if Vicky doesn't clean up her yard, fines will continue to stack up. The courts could get involved and force Vicky to let the city help out. But this work can cost thousands of dollars, all billed to the owner. And the lack of plumbing in the house? No laws are being broken there.
If you want to set up a tent in your living room and live that way, it's your property. You can do that.
Mm-hmm. At this point, you're probably wondering, why doesn't Jeff Hayes move?
I guess I'm a glutton for punishment. The worse it gets, the more I refuse to leave, because I'm not going to leave until it gets better.
And are you willing to die for this?
No, I'm not willing to die for it. I try to balance that line between doing something and not putting my personal safety at risk.
Vicky doesn't want anyone else to get hurt either. She doesn't want anyone else to die. And while she has talked about selling her house, she really doesn't want to move away from the neighborhood her family has called home since the 1940s. She wants to do right by her neighbors. She wants the same thing that Jeff wants. No crime, no drama. But as she said earlier, she's a little stuck right now.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about In My Backyard. So, for a lot of residents in Tacoma, in the late 90s and early 2000s, this was a pretty common complaint.
It sucks when it would end up in my yard. I would walk outside to get the mail, and there's a bottle of Old English on the ground. And when you go to the park, Dad, why is that guy sleeping or peeing on himself?
That's Tacoma resident Brent Clark. And of course, public inebriation is not limited to Tacoma. It happens everywhere. But in 2001, Tacoma was the first city in the state to develop what they called an alcohol impact area. So Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad joins me now to explain exactly what that means. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Gabe. So now, these days, there are many of these alcohol impact areas in Washington State. They exist in Olympia and Spokane and Pioneer Square. But like you said, the first in the state started in an area that makes up Tacoma's downtown and hilltop neighborhoods. And the basic idea was that in this area, retailers and bars and such would no longer be allowed to sell high alcohol content, low cost beverages.
So these are like your malt liquors, fortified wines,
yeah,
that kind of
stuff. Yeah, basically something you might buy if you were looking to get super drunk, super quick, super cheap.
Ah.
And more often than not, when someone found a bottle in their front yard or a police officer would get a call about public drunkenness, it involved these types of alcohol.
Okay, so how big was this problem in Tacoma?
Okay, well, I asked Carol Wolf that question. She works for the city of Tacoma in the Community and Economic Development Department and was involved in the creation of Tacoma's first alcohol impact areas.
We actually had a litter posse where they had the children who went to Bryan Elementary pick up bottles. And when we actually had a public meeting with our city council, they had, I believe it was over 1,000 bottles that they had picked up. To have these children bring these bottles and line them up on tables, it really was a visual for what the extent of the damage it was causing in the neighborhoods. We also had an individual, at the time he was the $3 million man. Over time, they had tracked how much money had been spent on picking this man up off of the street, taking him to the emergency rooms, taking him through detox, and it was $3 million over time.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's just one guy. So I think you get the basic idea here. Get rid of these types of alcohol in these areas and potentially see a reduction in litter, public drunkenness, calls to the EMTs, calls to the police, so on and so on. And so they did it. The alcohol impact area was created in Tacoma's downtown hilltop area, and you could no longer buy these drinks there.
So this plan, did it work?
So Carol Wolf told me that after a year, there were some pretty significant results.
We had a 35% decrease in emergency medical service incidents, and that was huge. And during that same period of time, there was a 15% increase in EMS incidents outside of the AIA. So we knew it wasn't overall the city's calls for service weren't being reduced. It was particularly within the alcohol impact area. The public perception was huge. About 22% of people living in the AIA and 26% of the retailers said that the number of persons drinking alcohol in public in their neighborhood has decreased significantly. And that experience of what people felt was safer was as important to us as those decreases in calls for service, because that means it really is working when perception and reality line up.
Okay, so a lot of good numbers in there, but one of those that stands out to me is this 15% increase in calls in areas that are outside the alcohol impact area. What's going on there?
Yeah, and officials in Tacoma noticed that number too. So Tacoma went ahead and created new alcohol impact areas on the east side and then in the north and west Tacoma. So now, basically, the only places you can get these high-volume, low-cost drinks are in South Tacoma and near the Port of Tacoma.
I see. Okay. So, all right. How's it going, though? Is everybody happy with how it's working?
If there's less calls to the police or the EMTs, obviously good thing, right? If residents aren't finding garbage in their front yards, people are happier, right? But I talked to Frank Jackson, who is the Senior Director of Programs at the Tacoma Rescue Mission, and here's what he had to say.
I've noticed a shift in where the garbage is. It may not be at the downtown area, but it certainly is close to the beginning of South Tacoma Way, which is where our facility is. We go out and pick up garbage a lot, and so we're seeing more garbage pickup.
Jackson also said that just because you take one thing off the shelf, that doesn't mean that your addiction goes away, and there's always substitutes.
They've taken away the high-octane booze out of the corner stores, some of them, but then in the grocery store, you can buy liquor bottles now. And so the sad thing about addiction is that it is greedy and it will take you to wherever it is you need to get what it is you need to use.
Well, that actually raises an interesting question because it seems like they're getting a lot of results from these alcohol impact areas in terms of calls to police and EMTs and stuff like that. But I think a lot of people would say that the real root of the problem is the addiction, you know, the actual sickness itself. And I'm wondering if that is being addressed at all.
Well, when you use words like root or core of the problem here, that's interesting that you say that. Here's Carol Wolf.
Today in Tacoma, we have evolved into really looking at root cause for these issues and not just the physical manifestation outside on the street. So we are investing heavily in homelessness solutions and housing stability.
Okay, but then there's the question, what comes first? Should a roof go over the head first, or should there be a cure for the addiction first? A guy like Frank Jackson from the Tacoma Rescue Mission would probably say that a place to live is great, but it can be like a Band-Aid, and the addiction needs to be addressed first.
I see. So there's a lot. There's definitely people on both sides of this.
Yeah.
It's kind of an eternal question. But I mean, what's the answer? Is there an answer?
Well, there's certainly a lot of data, and there's certainly a lot of differences of opinion on this. I will say I decided to give Mike Lonegren a call, and he was involved in the creation of the first alcohol impact area when he worked for the Tacoma Rescue Mission, and then was on the Tacoma City Council when the alcohol impact areas were expanding. And he told me that there might not be a silver bullet, but we can use all of these little puzzle pieces that we have to assist in breaking the cycle.
There's disagreement even as to what is the right kind of compassion to show people. Is it to let them do whatever they want, whenever they want? Or is there a tough love component? I often, when I had the chance to talk to people who were dealing with addiction, would really ask them, do you believe that you were created for this purpose to be chasing after, whether it's heroin or fortified wine every day? Is that the purpose that you're on earth for? And of course, they knew it wasn't. And I still get a chance to meet people around town who once were terribly addicted and now are gainfully employed with a happy family. So it isn't all gloom and doom. There is light at the end of the tunnel, and maybe the incentive to break this cycle of panhandling a few dollars and then going and getting blind drunk every day, if you do something to break that cycle, you might be helping to save that life.
Okay, so in Tacoma, we're seeing, you know, a different kind of intervention than we're seeing in Seattle, but it's certainly butting up against the same problems.
Got it. All right. Well, thanks, Kevin.
You bet.
Sound effect producer Kevin Kniestedt. Welcome back. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect on KPLU. Our theme today is In My Backyard. We heard earlier about how tensions between residents and their homeless neighbors go way back in Seattle's story. Leonard Garfield of the Museum of History and Industry says early on, transient people lived mainly in tenements and flop houses. And then when the Great Depression hit, the homeless population spilled out onto unused land, forming communities that sound remarkably like the encampments Seattle is grappling with today.
There was no public safety net. What happened, though, was that the homeless in Seattle tended to congregate, and they congregated in communities that actually became rather formal neighborhoods. In fact, famously, Hooverville, not far from where the stadiums are today, sort of south of downtown, was one of the largest encampments of homeless people in the country. But it had kind of an infrastructure, including a mayor.
Wow. So what did that Hooverville look like?
Well, it looked like a series of shacks with tar paper and newspaper. It was a pretty down-and-out, beaten-up place. But it had its own post office, and it had services. It provided for itself, in a sense, and that was one of the ways it was allowed to stay within the city and not be subject to great sort of police actions and that sort of thing.
So was it always sort of tolerated? Did people just ignore it? Or how did the city fathers and law enforcement and the neighborhoods around it confront the Hooverville when it began?
As time passed, attitudes changed. And while there was fear and concern in the general community in those initial years, and even some vandalism and hostility, as time passed and administrations passed at City Hall, there was a more accepting attitude. But there was the expectation and the requirement that the community keep itself together in the sense of monitoring criminal activity, in terms of monitoring health conditions. And it was a very desperate time in a very desperate neighborhood. I don't mean to mischaracterize it. But it was a community that began to build a social infrastructure. And that gave it a kind of sense of settlement that allowed the surrounding city, the city that wasn't so hard hit, to accept it within its midst.
So you said that there were social services, there was a post office. I mean, was this stuff like the city came in and picked up garbage, or was it that people were taking care of each other?
Pretty much people were taking care of each other. There were social service visits. There were what we would call today nonprofit organizations. The churches were involved. But the residents organized themselves as well, and they would occasionally appeal and petition the city council for services of some sort.
So there's some obvious, at least seeming, parallels between Hooverville and some of the encampments and tent cities of today, such as the jungle. Where do you see the similarities and differences there?
I think there was much more visibility to Hooverville. I mean, the jungle is visible if you look for it. Hooverville was pretty hard to avoid, and so therefore it became a more obvious presence in the community, and in some ways a more accepted presence. I think the other thing is, in the early 20th century, we were more used to seeing people who struggled at different points in their life. There wasn't a kind of network of services that were available. And I think there is the assumption that people today who are homeless are willfully choosing not to take advantage of services that are there. In the 1930s, there were no services there. And the people who found themselves homeless, there but for the grace of God go I think was a more common response.
So we read a couple of letters earlier on in the show, one from a committee of people from Hooverville talking about taking care of themselves, and another from someone in one of the neighborhoods around Inner Bay talking about an encampment there. What do we know about how neighbors dealt with this? I mean, was this an active debate about how to take on and handle the needs of these people?
What's interesting is in the early 20th century, we began to look at civic life as an arena that needed to be regulated. So we began to pass all kinds of regulations and standards and rules that pertain to the uses of property or the heights or shapes of buildings or even the kinds of people that could live in certain neighborhoods. So I think that the notion of people organizing as communities was definitely a fairly new feature of the early 20th century.
So from the point of view of a historian, what do you think the chief lessons are from this period, the Great Depression period, that we can be mindful of today?
Well, you know, I think that on both sides, both the neighborhood groups that sort of looked out for their own nice, tidy neighborhoods, and in the homeless communities themselves, where they organized to find strength despite their stress, I think we see that coming together collectively as communities and really looking to ourselves for solutions is obviously an important path. And I think that's something that's always worth remembering, is that communities tend to do much better when the community is working together than it does when it's just a series of individuals who happen to be next door.
Well, Leonard Garfield is executive director of MOHI, the Museum of History and Industry. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here, and now we have one more story of how neighborhoods and homelessness coexist. For this, we head back to Magnolia and Inner Bay in Seattle, where residents have hired private security to patrol the neighborhood. One resident who ended up on the wrong side of that security is Andrew Harris. He's a tall, clean-cut blonde guy who's been living in Magnolia for almost 19 years. He works at a convenience store there. But for the last 6 months or so, Harris has been homeless, which is partly a conscious choice.
I just decided, well, half my income is going to rent, and if I'm in the park, then I can save that half of my income.
So what's it like living in your car?
I don't have any place to go. That's, you know, if I have a day off, I don't have anything to do, which is odd. I work 7 days a week, and so it isn't like I spend a lot of time in my car. It's just a place where I sleep when I'm not working.
You must have gotten to know people over the years working here for so long and
Absolutely.
Living here for so long. Yeah. Did people know that you were basically homeless?
No. I mean, hopefully to look at me, you wouldn't think that I was homeless. I take care of myself. I try to keep my clothes clean. You know, I wash up in the bathroom.
Have you noticed attitudes here changing about how people interact with homelessness and with sort of people on the margins?
As long as I've lived in Magnolia, there have been people camping out in RVs, in Inner Bay and on Thorndike. And now it's like some neighborhood crisis. Apparently, there's been a crime uptick in Magnolia. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that seems to be the perception from a small minority of people. The Magnolia Patrol Association chose to hire private security, basically mall cops, to come in this neighborhood and behave like police officers.
So how did you first encounter the private security personnel?
Well, actually, they came into my work and like straight up said to me, we're going to get rid of the homeless people in Magnolia. That was said to me, that direct quote.
Were you homeless at that time?
I was, and I didn't say anything. I was just like, what the hell? You don't even realize who you're talking to because I don't look homeless, you know?
And then fast forward now to what brought you to this area that we're standing. Could you tell us where we are and how you wound up here?
Well, we're on the corner of 27th Avenue and Commodore Way, down by Fisherman's Terminal in Magnolia.
You were here to get some rest.
Yeah, oh, of course, yeah. So my window was down a good 3 inches, and I had my seat reclined. I had my sleeping bag over me. You know, suddenly somebody was banging on my window, and it was Toomey. I'd see, been in the store where I worked.
And spell out who Toomey is?
Toomey is, or was, the guard that the Magnolia Patrol Association had hired to come in and patrol the neighborhood, whatever that is, drive around in his Humvee. So I just rolled up my window. I felt like that was the best thing I could do to say, hey, I don't want to associate with you. And so I turned on my car to get power. I rolled up my window and shut it back off. But my car, when you shut it off, it automatically unlocks the doors. So he immediately reached down and opened my car door. So now he's standing between my door and the car. And Toomey is screaming at me, saying that I'm illegally parked, I need to leave or I'm going to jail. I don't know what he was thinking. I mean, I'm not illegally parked. There was nothing illegal in my car. I wasn't high. I wasn't drunk. There was absolutely no reason to think that I would be going to jail.
Okay, so what happened next?
He left and walked back to his Hummer. What I didn't know at this time is that Toomey was already calling the police.
There is a white male inside. He was smoking some sort of, I don't know if it's meth or crack.
I just thought, you know, and I had interacted with Toomey before, I thought, I want to go and ask this guy what makes him think it's okay. And I assumed also that he would recognize me because he'd been in the store. And I said, what the makes you think it's all right to come up and bang on my window like that? He said, sir, you know, I've been hired by people here in Magnolia to, you know, observe and report suspicious behavior, and you're sleeping in your car, and that's suspicious. But coming up and banging on my door and opening my car door isn't observing and reporting something, it's just harassing me. And, you know, just as I was about to bring the phone back up to record to me, he slapped the phone out of my hand, hit the ground, broke into three pieces. You know, I reached under the car and I was picking up the battery and he shouted like, hey, what are you doing? As soon as I got these two components, he sprayed me in the face with pepper spray. And I started to move back to my car and I made it maybe 3 feet. And he walked up behind me, reached over my left shoulder, put the canister of pepper spray about an inch away from my face, and started blasting it into my eyes.
What's that feel like for those of us who haven't been sprayed in the face with pepper spray?
It feels like somebody throwing acid in your eyes.
So what happened then?
So I attempted to open my car door. I got it about this far open, and Toomey came up with his body and slammed against me and pinned me against the side of my car. And I think instinctually, I just tried climbing into the car, and then I saw something fall. And it was his can of pepper spray. He had dropped it into my car. But I was still trying to rationalize with the guy. And so I reached out and picked up the pepper spray and said, here. And the jackass took it and started spraying me in the face again.
He sprayed you after you gave it to him?
I kid you not. That was the best thing I thought I could do in that split second moment to say, I am absolutely no threat. You know, I realized he wasn't going to stop. I said, what do you want? He said, I want to handcuff you. And I said, fine, handcuff me then. And I said, well, he said, you're going to jail. You're going to jail now. And I said, for what? He shouts, you assaulted me. And I said, you don't recognize me, do you? I said, you've been in my store 5 or 6 times. I've lived in this neighborhood for almost 20 years. And I asked him, I said, you don't remember me? And he said, no.
What were you hoping that would accomplish?
It was a constant escalation on his part. And by saying, look, this is who I am and this is my identity in the neighborhood, I was trying to de-escalate and neutralize the situation. And so in the end, they ended up calling a sergeant, and the sergeant said, there are no witnesses. You know, he says one thing and you say another thing, so I'm just going to have you guys both go your separate ways.
How has this whole incident affected you? Has it changed your life or the way you kind of move through your day and the way you think about the neighborhood at all?
Oh, absolutely. People directly have been supportive of me. I mean, I've worked at the store for 5 years, and everyone has been supportive, and yet it's still embarrassing. I mean, I've had people come in and say, you're homeless? And this is something that I've worked very hard to shield myself from. I mean, nobody in the neighborhood would know that I'm sleeping in my car had that not happened. I want to say I like everybody in the neighborhood. I don't think I like the 135 or 150 people who hired Toomey very much. And I don't know that any of them said, hey, go pepper spray Andrew. I don't think that happened. But that is what happened. And in the end, when all of this is resolved, I will probably not remain in Magnolia. And I don't even know if I'll continue to reside in Seattle. I no longer feel comfortable in the neighborhood. I used to go out to eat at neighborhood restaurants on my days off. I don't know if I'm ever going to go into those places again because I feel embarrassed, and I don't know if somebody is going to say across the bar, which has already happened, hey, are you homeless?
Andrew Harris lives, for now, in Magnolia. We reached out several times to the Magnolia Patrol Association and to the firm they hired, Central Protection. They did not respond. The blog The Sea is for Crank published a police report in which Toomey says Harris grabbed for him twice. You can read it along with more about the backgrounds of the security personnel on that blog. We'll link to it at kplusoundeffect.org. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson. Thanks to Jennifer Wing for her story this week and to Erica C. Barnett. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find our podcast on iTunes. You can leave feedback there in the reviews or email soundeffect@kplu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. We'll be back next week when we'll consider whether you really are what you eat.
There were times where people would walk in the door of our restaurant and they would turn around and leave because we didn't have a buffet.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.